I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. Turkmenistan rarely makes the American headlines, but when it does hit the papers, typically it's because of its eccentric leader, President Saparmurat Niyazov, known as Turkmenbashi. Although you may have read some of his odd decrees, such as the banning of lip-syncing, opera, and ballet, at the same time, Turkmenistan is grappling with some major political, economic, and social issues that have been largely overlooked by the media. Joining me now as part of our weekly underreported feature are Cassandra Cavanaugh of the Open Society Institute and Philip Nubel of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He is talking to us from Bishkek, which is the capital of Kyrgyzstan. And I'm very pleased to welcome you both to our show. Hello. Philip, how far is Kyrgyzstan from Turkmenistan?
There is no common border, but it's basically in the same region of Central Asia, obviously.
Could you place Turkmenistan in an imaginary map for our listeners?
Yes, Turkmenistan is basically east of the Caucasus mountainous region. Bordering on one side, you have Azerbaijan, and on the other side of the Caspian Sea, you have Turkmenistan. It also has a very long and important border with Iran and Afghanistan.
Cassandra, President Turkmenbashi has been said to have developed a cult of personality. Would you call that accurate?
I would say it's very accurate. Turkmenistan has been described once before as the North Korea of Central Asia. I think that's very appropriate.
Has he based his cult of personality on what the Kims established in North Korea?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's clear that he's aware of the parallels. But they're certainly, in terms of his control over the economy, the media, every aspect of society, and the glorification and near deification of Saparmurat Niyazov, I think the parallels are there.
When did this begin? Is this something that was his initial intent, Philip?
Well, it started very early, right after Turkmenistan gained independence from the former Soviet Union in 1991, even though Turkmenbashi, as he's called now, the father of all Turkmens, in those days was still a sort of high apparatchik of the communist system and very loyal to Moscow. Turkmenistan is one of the last countries that actually declared independence from the Soviet Union. But I think that what was interesting at that time was that there was a huge historical and cultural vacuum and ideological vacuum in Turkmenistan because independence was sort of forced upon the country. And this is when he started building this cult of personality we're talking about.
And Cassandra, is that how he came up with the name Turkmenbashi, the father of all Turkmen?
Well, Niyazov has a very particular view of the Turkmen people and their needs. I mean, it is a tribal society, and to say, to call yourself the Bosh is like the head of a tribe, and he extends that to the head of a nation. So it's a very sort of ethnic, almost racist view of his people.
Can a positive side be put on this? You have a country that has a diverse number of peoples, and there's an attempt to create some kind of sense of national identity?
Well, the focus on the ethnicity of the Turkmen, I think, is overwhelmingly negative because it leads to enormous ethnic discrimination against the minorities. And the Turkmen, the population of Turkmenistan, according to the last census, is only 77% ethnic Turkmen, and the rest of the people are really quite heavily discriminated against.
What about, Philip, the people who came over during the Soviet period, the Russian Orthodox people, are they discriminated against?
Definitely, as Cassandra said, there are a substantial minority of non-Turkmens, and among those also non-Muslim people, because Turkmens are traditionally Muslim, and they have been suffering since the sort of mid-90s because this cult of personality has reached amazing levels, and of declaring, for example, this century the golden century of the Turkmens, meaning that if you're not ethnically Turkmen, you're not really part of Turkmenistan's society. And this does not affect only Russian Orthodox, but also other groups such as Armenians and even Muslim groups like the Azeris or the Kurds.
Didn't President Niyazov write a book called the Runama? What is the Runama, Cassandra?
The Ruhnama. The spiritual, his intended spiritual guide for all Turkmen, now in its second volume.
Is this like Mao's Little Red Book?
It's I haven't read Mao, so it's hard for me to compare, but it's a compendium of banalities and spiritual meanderings, and recently launched into space, you will note, in over-the-wire traffic in a satellite. So
he put it into space so that people in other from other planets can also learn from him?
Yeah, to live for all eternity, not to indulge in this sort of jokey usual discourse about Turkmenistan, but that's a good one. The very evil thing about the Rukhnama, as Philip is very well qualified to tell you, is that it's basically become the major, if not the only, text that's the basis for the Turkmenistan education system. So you're talking about a whole generation of young people having been de-educated, and the Rukhnama is the only thing that they know. All government officials are required to study it.
And Philip, you wrote a report on the youth of Turkmenistan for the International Crisis Group.
Yes.
Do they resent having to learn everything from this one book, the Rukhnama?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's why the comparison with Mao's Little Red Book is actually quite accurate, because you really have to study this book from basically kindergarten time until you get to work, which means that study groups are formed at school level, at the work level, and you have to spend one day a week to study the book in groups. What I mean is that the Rukhnama becomes really the only reference regarding your identity, regarding the past and the future. And if you compare it to the Soviet period, where people actually, which is quite amazing, had a much bigger exposure to other cultures, at least within the socialist bloc. And that's why it's so dangerous today, because you have a generation of people who know nothing but the Rukhnama, which has a very particular, of course, vision of the country, because it suggests that President Niyazov was chosen by Allah as a possibly 13th prophet. So this is really the level of sort of political manipulation that you have in Turkmenistan today.
But that's only possible if the country becomes very isolated from its neighbors. Has there also been a move to isolate the country in the way that Myanmar has isolated itself?
Absolutely. Travel in and out of Turkmenistan is very strictly controlled by the State Security Ministry. The borders are even more strictly patrolled, especially with Uzbekistan, its neighbor and fellow former Soviet state. Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan share a very intermixed ethnic population across the border, and it's an enormous hardship for people who have family, kin, and friends on the other side that they're now largely stopped from going across, except for with the payment of enormous bribes. So yeah, the country is it's cut off in its mass media. Last year, or perhaps earlier this year, he outlawed international courier services. It's going towards that Myanmar state.
So all of these things that look silly at first glance actually have real meaning. For example, when he forbids men to grow beards, is that because he wants to control a certain religious conduct? Philip?
I think one interesting comparison to be made is with Turkey and the role that Atatürk, the father of all Turks, plays in sort of Turkish history, mentality, and modern history. And I think that to go back to our earlier questions, in 91, when Niyazov, back then he was not Turkmenbashi, took over power, he was actually respected and regarded by a lot of intellectuals, because, as Cassandra said, Turkmenistan never experienced statehood. It's a very clanic, divided society, very little, for example, cross marriages between different clans within the Turkmen nation. So he was very well respected in that regard.
Well, how does one enforce this sort of thing? Is the state very repressive, or are the people very, very open to being forced to do this sort of thing?
The former. The state is enormously repressive. The state security ministries have penetrated all segments of society, all institutions, informing on your neighbor. It's something, all repressive countries work with a balance of fear and incentives, right? Because the economy is so closely controlled by the state, you have an enormous incentive to obey its edicts, because your own survival of your family is very insecure. So the repressive mechanisms are enormous and very powerful.
Is this unique to the area, Philip?
Yes, I would say that, as we said earlier, it's really the North Korea of the region. And if you just look at the political system of Turkmenistan, you will see that any minister or really official at the highest level has been eventually sacked, his entire family or her entire family deported from their houses, imprisoned, and the only way out is if you manage soon enough to leave the country. So this is a very repressional state, absolutely.
I read recently, after the United States was forced out of its military base in Uzbekistan, that Turkmenistan was a possible replacement. Wouldn't that change everything, Cassandra?
Well, I think I'd point your listeners to an article on our website today. The Open Society Institute runs Eurasianet. It's a source for information about the region. And one of the analysts who writes there says that this is most likely a piece of Russian disinformation intended to shoehorn the Turkmens back into more obedience towards Moscow. At the recent CIS summit, Turkmenistan announced that it was going to ramp down its status to observer status within the CIS, and that makes Russia very uncomfortable. It likes to maintain the show of a CIS as a powerful regional body, but yet Turkmenistan is very proud of its neutral status. So I really don't give very much credence to this story at all, although it must be said that the U.S., on the one hand, while it's quite critical of Turkmenistan and its human rights record in some fora, also does a good bit of work to try to maintain some kind of a working relationship with Turkmenistan, because Turkmenistan is simply, it's on a very useful piece of geography.
Next to Afghanistan.
Bordering Afghanistan, has been the base for transshipments of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. We have overflight rights. So there's a delicate balance in the relationship, I would say, with the U.S.
Well, North Korea has terrible relations with the U.S. What about Niyazov? Would he want to work more closely with the United States?
It's hard to say. I think Niyazov's stance is very much that he doesn't need anyone or any sort of international sponsors or enormous international cooperation, because he has gas and he has total control over the people in his country. So you don't see him traveling or seeking out at very many high levels of international cooperation with anyone.
We'll get to that gas in just a moment, the natural resources of Turkmenistan, but at the same time, the extreme poverty of the country and what some of President Niyazov's policies have done to the poor who live outside of the big city. As we continue this conversation with Cassandra Cavanaugh of the Open Society Institute and Philip Neubel of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, we're speaking to him from Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. By the way, we also have a link to EurasiaNet on our website in case you want to read that report. Stay with us. We're talking about Turkmenistan on today's Underreported. My guests are Philip Neubel, N-O-U-B-E-L, of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. We're speaking to him from Bishkek, capital of Kyrgyzstan, and with Cassandra Cavanaugh. She's in the studio. She's from the Open Society Institute. Philip, how often have you gone to Turkmenistan?
Well, I was there 2 years ago because, as we said earlier, it's a very close country. I would say even more close than Burma, and it's very difficult since the failed assassination attempt that happened in November 2002 to actually get inside the country once you have started reporting on it and they know your name. It's very difficult to get a visa. It's difficult to get just inside the country. Nevertheless, there are a lot of Turkmen people throughout the region. For example, in Kyrgyzstan, there are about 100 Turkmen students studying here, so it's still possible to maintain some sort of contact. But unfortunately, I cannot go back to Turkmenistan at this point.
Usually when there's a cult of personality, assassination attempts actually will leave a power vacuum. Cassandra, are there any people in line to take over in case another one is attempted and succeeds?
Well, yes. The short answer is we don't know. As Philip pointed out earlier, the problem, or rather the genius of Turkmenbashi's system of rule is that this constant rotation of cadres, the minute he appoints someone to an important ministerial post, a year or 6 months later, they'll be out and all their family members with them. So he doesn't give anyone a chance to build up experience of governing or administration. The most important opposition leaders are outside the country, and they still maintain that they have forces and followers within Turkmenistan, but that's very difficult to gauge.
Well, the International Crisis Group released a report last year that stated Turkmenistan could be on the brink of political and social collapse. A repressive regime usually is pretty stable. How unstable is this country?
Well, I think partly that report was occasioned by a series of important defections from Turkmenistan's former finance minister and other people who had been very privileged in controlling some of the main revenue sources of the state. And it seemed to indicate that Turkmenbashi's own ability to draw supporters into his government was waning. But I think one of the more important sides of that report is how it points us to the general disintegration of the social fabric, of the public health network, of the education network, of all of the kind of the warp and woof of society in Turkmenistan. That's a very great danger, not only to the people there, to its neighbors, and to us generally.
What is Turkmenistan's relationship to its neighbors, Philip? We know it's closed off. Do any of its neighbors consider it a friend?
Yeah, that's a very good question. As we said, Turkmenistan prides itself on having this unique policy that it wanted recognized by the UN of sort of absolute neutrality, meaning that they officially regard all countries, including neighbors, equally. Of course, the reality is quite different. I would say that because Uzbekistan has been in the news lately after the May 13th unrest in Andijan in the Fergana Valley, the relationship with Uzbekistan, with whom it shares a really important border and mixed ethnic minorities on both sides, is actually very bad. There had been some allegations that maybe part of the Uzbek secret services had taken part in the assassination attempt in 2002. And what happened in Andijan, of course, has sort of reinforced the suspicion of their Uzbek neighbor. Regarding Kazakhstan in the north, relations, because they're quite limited to strictly economic, to an economic level, are, I would say, actually rather neutral, and because Kazakhstan does not really need Turkmenistan, so they're not really bothered. Relations with Iran are quite interesting because there's an extensive border, there's a sort of shared cultural and historical past, and because of this alleged neutrality, Turkmenistan is sometimes trying to play a role on the side of Iran, eventually against the West, eventually against Russia when it comes to disputes in the Caspian Sea. With Afghanistan, it has also an interesting relationship because there is a small ethnic Turkmen minority in Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan does play an important role in the sort of development aid distribution to that country. And going back to the relationship with Russia, with whom it doesn't have a sort of land border, but Russia is also a country of the Caspian Sea, I think that the reason why Turkmenistan might have sort of downgraded its membership with the Commonwealth of Independent States in Kazan last month is that because, and I'm sure we're going to talk about oil and gas reserves, all the oil and gas that is in Turkmenistan, and it's a huge quantity, has to transit via Russia. And so Russia has a huge amount level of leverage on Turkmenistan politically and economically, because if it closes the sort of pipeline, then all the rich Turkmenistan is basically stuck in the region, because there are so far no other major pipelines that would allow Turkmen oil and gas resources to get out of the country.
How much can we actually know about the assassination attempt? A listener wrote me a note about an experience she had while she was living in the capital. She said that a friend of hers survived a plane crash, and then she read in the newspapers a little note. It said, "You may have heard that there was a plane crash. There wasn't." And that was, I guess, the way the government dealt with anything that might be embarrassing. Do we know much about the assassination attempt of 2002 on President Niyazov?
It's very, very difficult, as we said earlier, to verify information because there are virtually no media as such in Turkmenistan, and this has been going on now for almost a decade. Of course, the government's version has been compared to other versions given by the opposition, by foreign sources, and it's very difficult. There was a sort of version that seemed true, but some people said maybe it was not the case, that a sort of motorcade was attacked and that people were shooting at Niyazov's car in Ashgabat. That's one version that comes up quite oftenly, but unless you had been at the scene, and I had not been at the scene on that day, it's very difficult to be 100% sure of what happened.
Now, you've mentioned that Turkmenistan is rich in oil and natural gas. It also has a fair amount of drug trade because poppies are grown there. Is that enriching the country as a whole, or is this something that is mostly enriching the few people at the top?
Well, this is another area that's very opaque and hard to know anything about. It has been reported in the media basically on the basis of information supplied by the opposition and rumors that Niyazov himself personally controls. I mean, it's probably true that Niyazov personally controls all of the incoming resources from oil, gas, other important exports, and that he has this in personal accounts held outside the country. I mean, the latest data on household income is from 1998, but even then it was reported by the World Bank that 44% of the population was living under $2 a day, and that was 6 years ago.
There's no trickle-down in this country.
Very little. I mean, Niyazov, for a while, he was giving people free, you know, cooking gas and salt and a few other commodities, But most people who've been there and observers say that there's been a noted impoverishment over the last 6 years. So the picture is not good in that regard.
My guests are Cassandra Cavanaugh of the Open Society Institute and Philip Neubel of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He's talking to us from Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan. And this is Underreported on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. The capital city, Ashgabat, has undergone major development since Niyazov took power, hasn't it? What's going on there, Philip?
Well, yes, as you say, very correctly, if you go to Ashgabat now, or I've seen pictures recently, it looks more and more as a sort of striking, beautiful city that you would probably place in an Arab emirate in the Gulf. A lot of gold, a lot of marble, foreign companies like the French group Bouygues building amazing palaces, mosques that are very seldom visited by the local people.
Who's living in the palaces?
That's just a big... Sorry?
Who's living in the palaces? Is this kind of like what happened in Bucharest during the Ceausescu regime, where the Ceausescus just built palace after palace for themselves?
I think the comparison is quite correct, but it's in the sort of level of Central Asia and of oil money that is sort of invested into that. So it's even more grand-looking. But the minute you leave Ashgabat and you sort of travel across the country, you have a completely different picture of a lot of people still living outside the capital city, and where in most villages and small towns, you will very seldom have electricity or running water. You will see a lot of children walking without shoes, and people having an extremely difficult life because of this policy of total control, little transparency, and frankly speaking, a policy that is not understandable by most of the people inside Turkmenistan, especially when they compare it to the Soviet period, which again looks as a sort of an area of time of prosperity and peace and openness compared to what they have been experiencing in the past 15 years now almost.
Cassandra, hasn't he actually been dismantling some of the basic institutions outside of the capital city? Healthcare, for example, education.
It was a shocking decree for many people. I believe it was in 2003 when he announced that he was closing hospitals and outside of the capital city and dismissing most healthcare personnel, and they were going to be substituted with army conscripts. To essentially what it was is a radical privatization of healthcare, when before the people's expectation was that there would be some basic level of state care. Yes, they would have to pay bribes to get it, but now it's, you know, return to the year zero, essentially. Education as well. You know that he's reduced secondary school education to 9 years, college to 2 years, but many, many children don't have access to that education at all because of the informal school fees they're required to pay.
So they'd have to, if they even had the money, wind up moving to the capital city? Isn't that a recipe for disaster if you keep on forcing people to come into the big city?
Well, it would be if there wasn't the reinforced Soviet system of control over people's movements, the prepiska system. You have to obtain permission, essentially, to live in the capital or to move outside your area of residence. And in fact, President Niyazov has been, in effect, forcing people out of the capital because in these grandiose reconstruction plans, he's leveled whole quarters of the city, in essence leaving people homeless. Sometimes they're promised replacement housing, but often that's not supplied.
I understand there's also been a rise in prostitution in the capital. Philip?
Yes, because of a sort of a certain presence, of course, of foreign workers, mostly from Turkey, visitors from Iran, who come to Turkmenistan, and even though it might sound sort of paradoxical to us, in the sort of social norms, Turkmenistan is freer than Iran in terms of alcohol consumption, in terms of prostitution. And of course, because there are high levels of drug consumption within Turkmenistan, I think that the most important thing to remember is that even Turkmenistan does not necessarily produce a lot of drugs. It is a very important transit zone because it gets drugs from Iran and from Afghanistan, that are then put on ships across the Caspian Sea, and then they can reach the Caucasus or southern Russia. So usually high levels of drug consumption and prostitution go together.
This
and
kind
of course, with the sort of disastrous consequences of HIV levels.
This kind of situation, these policies, it sounds to me, are the sorts of things that foment rebellion. Why haven't we seen it? Is it because the state has remained so repressive?
I think so. I'd be hesitant to ascribe it to any kind of trait of the Turkmen national character or passivity.
I've been told that they're very friendly. Yeah. In fact, love Americans. An American who was there said she was invited into everyone's home. She drank more tea than she ever wanted to because everybody was so nice. They were so interested in Americans. But the minute she left their homes, the secret police hassled her, assumed that she was a spy. She couldn't travel from one county to another. She had to pay bribes all the time to do the most basic things. That sounds like the sort of life that most people would not accept.
But it also is an example of the all-pervasiveness of the security system and the repressive apparatus. If every move of yours is tracked, if every step that you want to take as a Turkmen citizen needs to be accompanied by a bribe, if you get dismissed from your job, how are you going to survive? And so what are you going to do that's going to put your survival at risk? It would be exceptional, and it would require leaders and the kind of opportunities, I think, for rebellion or not. Are not there. I don't know. Philip has a different view.
Philip, you have other ideas?
Yeah, I completely agree, but I think that it's also important to sort of remember that really Niyazov was sort of lucky, if I can say enough, to come at a time when there was really no sense of what being Turkmen as a nation means. And that's why in the very early years, there was, I think, genuine support because people thought, well, maybe this is our Atatürk and maybe we have to learn what does it mean not to be Soviet anymore but to be Turkmen. And he used this time to sort of build this incredible cult of personality. And now, of course, it's too late because you have a very repressive system, because you have no free media, there's no free information, there's no freedom of travel. So people don't really know what is happening even within their own country, not to speak about the region or the rest of the world. So there's a level of people being naive enough, thinking, well, maybe that's good for us. Maybe in the next 5 years we'll have a better life. That's what you sometimes hear in the countryside. And people who are more exposed to news somehow, because you still have, for example, satellite dishes in the city, fully realize that this is a full disaster. But the minute you speak up, you risk for your life and for the life of your entire family. So it's a really very stressful situation if you want to have different opinions.
Well, a human rights disaster of this sort, you'd assume, would have gotten the world's attention, that people be discussing it in the UN the way they discuss what goes on in North Korea and in Burma and other countries that are like this. Why has Turkmenistan slipped under the radar, do you think, Cassandra?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily has. I mean,
Are people debating this at the UN?
There was a UN General Assembly resolution, which is not an insignificant thing, last November against Turkmenistan. I believe Russia, its main protector, abstained, but yet it was passed by a good majority. That's very condemnatory. I think that's an indication more of the facility, if you will, of UN human rights mechanisms than it is that they're not working properly. They do. Turkmenistan just presented its report, as it's required to do, to the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and it was roundly condemned. But the question is, so what then? I mean, I guess a special rapporteur for Turkmenistan, sort of more intrusive forms of UN diplomacy would be called for. But yet one would ask then, what effect would they have?
But this is a recipe for disaster. It's likely at some point Niyazov will be assassinated or die or get sick or something. And he seems to have dismantled the whole country. What are the prospects for the future, Philip? You've spoken to the young people.
Mm-hmm. I think that if you look at Uzbekistan, we might find some answers to your earlier questions. Why is the world maybe not so responsive to Turkmenistan as it is to Burma, let's say, or to North Korea? Because Central Asia is, generally speaking, very badly reported in world news. People are still not very knowledgeable about the region. Then there was a second myth that was shattered after Andijan that, well, maybe, you know, it's a Soviet, post-Soviet society. People are not mature enough for democracy. Maybe they do need very strong rulers. And I think that was part of the policy of the United States towards Uzbekistan. And because you have oil and gas reserves in both countries and military interests, I think now the picture is completely different. People have understood that this is a recipe for disaster, and that unless we have true democratization, we're, you know, calling for a major sort of social problem that could erupt into violence linked to drugs, to international terrorism.
I want to thank you both so much for participating in today's Underreported. We've been talking about Turkmenistan, which is definitely underreported, despite the policies of President Saparmurat Niyazov. And my great thanks to Philip Neubel of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. We spoke to him from Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan. That's the capital of Kyrgyzstan. And from our studios here in New York, Cassandra Cavanaugh of the Open Society Institute. Thank you both so much.